Southeast Command.
What's happened?
Context Southeast Command.
Delay that order.
Context Southeast Command.
This is the captain.
Context Southeast Command.
Get out of my chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery, a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Priyanka.
Well, Adam, we've got a big show lined up for today. We've got an interview coming up with a writer from Star Trek Enterprise, Chris Black. But I thought maybe first, get into some news.
That's right, Ben. Lots of newsworthy things happening. W/R/T... Star Trek Discovery.
And Star Trek in general.
Yeah, maybe the biggest being the Alex Kurtzman news, right? He inks a five-year deal with CBS, and part of this deal is to expand the Star Trek universe with possibly a number of different shows.
They're kind of going buck wild. I mean, there's all this peace do news flying around, and as far as I can tell, that's not, like, totally confirmed yet. But
and that's related to the Kurtzman thing because that would be one of the properties that Kurtzman is responsible for.
He's basically being anointed to turn on the fire hose of Star Trek content, and I don't know. I'm kind of the shows that are like rumored to be involved or have been hinted will be involved in this are a new show about Captain Picard. Captain Picard, the later years. I don't know what it's going to be called. Then there's a Starfleet Academy show, and the creators of the OC and Gossip Girl are apparently going to be the ones running that. And then a Wrath of Khan story, which I think had been on the chopping block before, but is now back, and an animated series.
Yeah. Makes me wonder if the animated series would be the Patrick Stewart vehicle.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, because one of the latest rumors we've been hearing is that there could be a TNG reboot or post-TNG series as a part of this package. And so much gossip about Patrick Stewart and whether or not he'll be involved or how close he is to signing on the line that is dotted.
Yeah.
Everyone's in a titter over
it. Oh, he's a verbal agreement or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
One thing that I've been thinking about a little bit is the starvation level desire people had for more Star Wars things.
Mm-hmm.
And now that they're getting them, people are being real assholes about it. like the Star Wars fan culture seems to be totally spiraling out of control in a way that is really insane to watch. Like the, you know, people that say that they're raising money to reshoot The Last Jedi because they hated The Last Jedi so much. And
those people are idiots. It should always be said that they're idiots.
Yeah. I agree. I was getting to that.
The Declaration of Star Wars Independence or whatever. Like, fuck that.
I have a little apprehension that if we have five Star Trek shows going at any given time to choose from. I mean, A, this is going to be exhausting for us because we're going to have a lot of pod to be making if that is the case. And B, I wonder, do people start to turn on it in the same shitty way that the Star Wars fans? I mean, obviously, like, Star Wars is doing fine. They're raking money in by the mint. But there's a lot of angry naysaying out there.
I'm kind of two minds about it. Like, on the one hand, I want to believe that Patrick Stewart's involvement in anything would be a seal of quality whose floor would be pretty high. But also, he was a part of Star Trek Nemesis. But also, like, on the third hand, no one could be more motivated to correct the end of one of his most beloved characters than Patrick Stewart. So I've got to believe that if he were to jump back into this pool, that it would be for all the right reasons.
One would hope. I got the sense that Akiva Goldsman is going to stay involved also. And the stuff I had heard previously was that Akiva Goldsman was really out over there,
out of
the writer's room at Disco and on his way out in general. But like, I kind of think that he has a lot of responsibility for some of the cornier parts of the J.J. Abrams reboots, like making them the kind of more dumbed down mainstream action movies that they are, and less about like the kind of stories that Star Trek is particularly good at telling. So I'm interested to see, like, what if these are the two guys that are going to be doing it, like, what does that mean about what their ethics are? You know, like, what do they want to preserve? Like, what do they think are the valuable parts of Star Trek that they want to keep? And what do they think are things that they can discard? And I'm sure that those will be controversial decisions no matter how they make them.
I think we could make a prediction based on how Star Trek Discovery turned out. I think that is going to be emblematic of the kind of Star Trek we get down the road. I think it has to be, right?
Lots more breakfast burritos in Star Trek's future.
I mean, it's a consolidation of Star Trek power is what this is.
It's like the Medellin cartel forming. Like Alex Kurtzman is Escobar, and he's getting all the drug dealers under his thumb.
Let's take these one by one. Like, what are you most excited about, and what are you least excited about if we're talking about these possible new series?
So I am cautiously optimistic about a post-TNG Star Trek. I think that's what I was hoping for when they announced that there was going to be a new Star Trek series.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to see something that is way further in the future, and I'm excited to see the kind of, you know, what that will force them to imagine, because I think that Star Trek has given us a lot of our conception of what the future could be like as a culture, and I don't think that when you're making prequels you're quite doing that work. So, you know, what new crazy ideas can they come up with that will actually, you know, change the way people imagine what the future could be.
Yeah.
I suppose I'm also pretty excited about this Starfleet Academy show. I mean, the pedigree on those showrunners is pretty fun to be running a show like that.
Yeah, tell me more about that pedigree. You mentioned the OC and what else?
Yeah, so it's Stephanie Savage and Josh Schwartz. They do Marvel's Runaways for Hulu right now, but they did Gossip Girl, and I think they did the OC.
Yeah, I think that's exciting to me personally. I really like the OC when it first came out.
Yeah, you're a big
OC
fan, right?
Yeah, I love the Josh Schwartz. Maybe we'll get a Peter Gallagher cameo here.
Are you an OC fan as well? Or, I mean, a Gossip Girl fan as well?
Yeah, I think that was that's a show I can blame my wife for liking. I have to admit, it was a guilty pleasure for sure.
This is like, yeah, this could be the show that I get my wife into Star Trek with, because she was a huge Gossip Girl fan.
Yeah.
And I could totally sell her a show, and then, you know, 13 minutes in, when there's a starship, she's gonna be like, wait a second. And then I'm gonna be like, give it time. Yeah, you're gonna like this.
Like sneaking the medicine in with the sugar.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm excited about the idea of an animated series because of how it could usurp budget in a live action series, like unconstrained from budget and making it about like what you could draw. I think that would be amazing. And to stock it with the voices that we've come to know and love, if the animated series is a TNG offshoot, I think that sounds fun. But conversely, if the TNG ends up being live action, and if it's a Picard-centric show, I mean, I thought Logan was a great film. And the idea of an end-of-life Captain Picard story, I find very interesting. And I would totally show up for a show like that.
Yeah. What if you had like unfinished, do you have any like unfinished business of Picard's that you'd like to see him go resolve? Does he retire to Mintaka and become the godhead that they always wanted him to be?
I think Beverly is a captain of a ship somewhere, and if she's in danger, I think a fun story is what a Captain Picard could do or would do in a circumstance like that.
He comes on as a management consultant on her starship.
I don't know. Like the thing that's unresolved about Picard is like, will he ever find love?
Yeah,
and it's
true.
It's weird to think that is of such interest to me as a like just general interest Star Trek fan. But I don't know. I think that's the thing about him I'd like to know more about. Like if we talk about happy endings for him, he's obviously a character that I care a ton about. I hope he's happy wherever he is, and I think finding a lady to share the remaining years of his life, I think, would be a big, big part of that.
Yeah. I'd also be kind of curious. I wish we had gotten some closure on the Spock thing, like Spock going to, mm-hmm. to Romulus mm-hmm. in TNG. And I feel like that was like a big arc that could have an interesting, it'd be an interesting place to play because we haven't really seen much of the Romulans in a long time.
Yeah.
You know, the diplomatic mission of Picard trying to pick up where Spock left off or something like that.
Geordi cool. just fucking B4 in his apartment.
Yeah. So.
Kind of a lot of potential options here.
Mr. LaForge, if you're going to frack a semi-animate sex robot, allow me to offer you one that doesn't look exactly like your best friend.
Jacob, for me, is someone who created his best friend in my late wife, Rashaan. Things can get pretty fucked up in a pretty short amount of time.
I never really understood the criticism, you know, the guys that go around saying, yeah, she's my wife, but she's also my best friend. But it actually turns out to be kind of a fucked up relationship dynamic. And I just don't want you to fall into the same thing because I respect you as a friend, Geordi.
Few people know that I also make a living doing consultations for those who wish to join the real Doe lifestyle.
I'm kind of the Dan Savage of, of the 21st century.
Look out for my podcast and column in alt weekly newspapers.
The X-Bridge Livecast.
Yeah, 5 years, Ben. 5 years of the Kurtzman Industrial Complex. I hope it's good.
This could get exhausting for us. We're gonna have to have a serious conversation about how we deal with this. That's basically what I'm anticipating.
It's gonna be a real I Love Lucy in the Chocolate Factory situation where we're recording pod as fast as show is getting made. I don't think they're gonna put out these concurrently. I don't get that feeling. Like, I think Star Trek for decades has tried. I mean, the overlap with DS9 and TNG notwithstanding, I think they have tried to sequentialize the release of things versus concurrently put stuff out. So I would hope that's how it goes going forward.
Yeah. It's like you get a Star Wars episode blank movie 1 year, and then you get something, a Star Wars story, the next year.
Right. Picard, a Star Trek story. Maybe that's what we get. Maybe there is no TNG crew. Maybe it's just Picard.
And they explain how he got the last name Picard, because we needed to find that out.
Nah, not really.
All right. Well, we got this interview, so why don't we cut to that? What do you say?
Let's do it.
We have been waiting for someone worthy of our attention.
What? Who are you?
We've encountered them.
Those are Klingons?
Chris Black is a writer and producer who has actually worked on some Star Trek in real life. He was a writer on Star Trek Enterprise, and he came in to talk to us about what it is like to write for a universe as well established as Star Trek is. So enjoy this interview now. Well, we're here with Chris Black, a television writer. Tell us what your credits are.
All of them, or
just germane to the subject of our program?
Well, I've been writing and producing television for 23 3 years. Wow. I started out, the first job I had was on a USA cable show, half-hour single-camera comedy called Weird Science, based on the John Hughes movie, that I did two seasons of. And then I did, you know, a fair amount of genre stuff. I did two seasons on Sliders, as I sort of jokingly say, the bad years, like after Fox canceled it and Sci-Fi Channel picked it up and they moved it to LA and slashed the budget.
That was like the cockroach of shows, I feel like. It was
We kept stomping on it, trying to kill it. And it just would scuttle, it would scuttle under the refrigerator and refuse to die.
Yeah.
Which is not fair to Sliders. It had a lot of fans. It was a lot of fun to work on. It was.
Yeah,
They were
a pest, but more like it could not be killed.
It could not be killed, although it... After two seasons of toiling under less than optimal circumstances, I felt like it basically deserved to die a dignified death rather than sort of keeping it on life support the way we did.
Well, after the just merciless dunk sesh we took on Babylon 5 last episode of this show, I think we should probably move on from Sliders before it gets ugly.
Okay. Well, look, I'm just like, you know, it's like anything. Well, it's a little bit of an object lesson. I mean, no one sets out to do a terrible television show, but sometimes, you know, you go in always with the best of intentions, you know, but sometimes circumstances conspire against. Anyway, so I did Weird Science and I did Sliders. I was in the sort of Rob Tappert, Sam Raimi universe for a little while. I did some episodes of Xena Warrior Princess.
Fun.
I worked a season on one of their less successful shows called Cleopatra 2525, which was a little bit of a sort of ill-advised project, but was great fun.
Is that ancient Egypt in the future?
No, it was. How do I even describe it?
Is that Cleopatra's better than perfect vision?
Yes, exactly. No, it was this.
Wait, well, didn't that mean she can read 25-point font at 25 feet?
Cleopatra's eye exam is just a bunch of like Egyptian symbols, like facing up and down and
exactly. How do you're doing on the test if you can't identify them?
Right,
it's like a hook with a cross, and then there's a thing. But no, it was three young, attractive women in sort of metal bikinis fighting robot monsters in a post-apocalyptic.
Sold in the room.
It was an odd piece. It was fun. We shot it in New Zealand. It was Rob. There were two half hours that were supposed to be sort of put together. The other half was this Bruce Campbell show called Jack of All Trades.
Whoa.
And so it was like the Action Pack, I think it was called. It was weird. This was back in the days of syndicated television when Rob Tappert was like the king of syndicated television. He had like five shows on the air. and it was cheesy fun. It shot in New Zealand, you know, and then the Jack of All Trades got canceled first. So they tried to then expand our half hour show into an hour, and it just kind of spiraled from bad to worse. And I did that. You can IMDb me. There's a bunch of bad failed credits, but then I wound up for three seasons on Star Trek Enterprise.
That would be, I guess, is why the vast majority of Star Trek Enterprise, right?
Yeah, exactly. three of the four. I was there for 75% of it, which I assume is why I'm here, sitting here today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that Adam and I have speculated about a lot, and with, you know, a fairly limited amount of expertise, is like, what it is like to try and write stories and characters in a universe that is like super well established. And I think Star Trek Enterprise is a previous example of that kind of a project,
right,
where like some of this is new mythos that you get to make up.
Right.
Some of it is new stories you get to tell because mythos is not established on a certain subject matter. But like, I don't know, like I've been thinking a lot lately about how the kind of television we make now is so different.
Right. Well, Enterprise was a weird animal, you know, and there's a lot of, it was, you know, I was there for 3 years. They asked me to come back for season four, and it was just, and I didn't, I opted not to. I had a 3-year deal and I left after the third season. Partly because it was so frustrating that it was, I guess, how much time do we have?
As much as I'd like.
First of all, I'd like to say it was a great experience. I mean, I grew up on, I wasn't old enough to have watched the original series when it was in prime time, but I watched it when it was in syndication and I would come home from school.
Sure.
And it was on in the middle of the afternoon on Channel 50 in Detroit. And I felt
that was me, but TNG and Channel 44 in the Bay Area.
Right, exactly. So it was like I fell in love with this, you know, with the show, the original, you know, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, old school Star Trek, and loved it. And one of the things that it, you know, and then watched it, I would not say obsessively, but you know, on and off through all of its iterations. You know, I can't quote chapter and verse the way you guys can, but I know all the series and most of the episodes, and and was always a fan of it. And then when I got the opportunity to go work on the show, it was a thrill. I mean, when Rick Berman and Brandon Braga, who were running the show, basically said, "Okay, we're going to give you a shot," it was like I hit the jackpot. And you go, and they were still shooting at it as they had done all the shows at Paramount.
Right.
And you would go on that lot and walk back. They had three big sound stages with these amazing sets.
Yeah.
You know, and they had built the ship so it was all connected. So you could walk from one, you know, you could leave the bridge and go into the captain's ready room and then go down a corridor and turn a corner and walk into sick bay. There were a couple of the two main ship sets were split on two separate sound stages. But when you would go in there, when they would light it all up, and at that point they were no longer the, you know, the cell, the backlit Okudagrams. They were actually, the Okudas were still doing all the graphics, but they were actual, like, you know, flat screen televisions on all those displays. So they would just fire everything up and you would walk in there and it was like you were on a spaceship.
Back when those flat screens were very expensive.
They were, and there were dozens and dozens of them, you know, and they had a little room, and each one of them was receiving a separate feed, a separate digital video file. So they had a little room, a little locked room on the soundstage with racks.
Every VHS player.
No, they were Mac minis. there were probably 40 of them.
Wow.
You know, just sitting in racks, and each one of them was feeding a separate.
Just playing a QuickTime file.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To those screens, and then they could change, you know, whatever the story required that week. You know, the art department, the Okudas in the art department would just come up with something new that they would throw up. So that part of it was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I got to go play in Gene Roddenberry's universe, you know, that I had wanted to do since I was a kid, you know, and there's people running around with phasers and pointed ears and you could, you know, it was like I died and gone to heaven. And then you got into the nitty gritty of trying, which I think goes more to the heart of your question. You got into the nitty gritty of actually trying to tell stories in this universe when so much had come before.
Yeah. There's so much stuff that you can't invalidate through a storyline. Like
it was challenging on a bunch of different levels. It was challenging on a very basic level of that's a story we've told before. You know, I mean, that when you would go in and pitch.
The Simpsons did it problem.
Yeah, exactly. Well, not even the Simpsons did it. You were going in with, I think at that point, there had been something along the lines of, if you include like the animated series, something like 700 hours of Star Trek.
Yeah. So it's like, what if there's some terraformers and.
Exactly. Like, no, what if the captain's mistaken for a god? You know, it was like, it was like, which we had an unwritten rule, you could never tell that story. But it was like. But it was like that, yeah. I mean, just on a very sort of basic writing for television level.
Yeah.
You would go in and say, yeah, what if there's a ship full of terraformers who does this or that? And someone would invariably say, oh, that's Next Gen Season 2, Episode 6.
Yeah. Is there, like, do these shows, like, employ somebody that has that kind of, like, you know, encyclopedic?
Well, there was not a dedicated person whose job it was, but by and large, the people who worked on the show were all fans of the show.
Right.
So the cumulative sort of, you know, group knowledge that everybody had, somebody would know.
Yeah. It'd be weird if they weren't fans of the show.
Well, but they, I don't think there was anyone who didn't like the show, but there was a sense of, you know, it was writing 1 hour dramatic television.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people ask me, they look at my credits and they go, oh, well, how do you go from Star Trek to Desperate Housewives, and which
is
I
that
did,
where you went?
I did two seasons of Desperate Housewives. I did a show called Ugly Betty. Yeah. I did a lot of stuff that was not genre material.
Did you ever accidentally write a scene where, like, Terry Hatcher beamed down to, and they're like, no, she doesn't beam anywhere.
As much as I would have loved to have beamed Terry somewhere, we did not do that.
Well, she went from Star Trek to Desperate Housewives, too, in a way.
Well, and yeah, because from
Lois and Clark. She was in that one TNG episode.
Oh, yeah, she was. But also, she also did Lois and Clark for, you know. Right. She was like in a genre space as well. Yeah. But that, I think, to some extent, illustrates my point, is writing is writing. Good dramatic writing is good dramatic writing. Yeah. And if you have a great set of characters in an interesting situation and you inject conflict into it, it doesn't matter to some extent whether it's playing out on the Bridge of the Enterprise or on Wisteria Lane. It's like you're working the same muscle to tell a story.
Yeah.
So those going into a Star Trek writer's room, you faced the same dramatic challenges that you did on any show, you know. But then layered on top of that, you had the weight of the entire Star Trek universe and the fan base sitting on your shoulders. It was like, when I say it was, well, it was challenging on a lot of levels. You had just on a practical level, you don't want to tell the same story over again.
Right.
The reverence for the series as a whole, that not necessarily canon, but the spirit of Star Trek that you didn't want to violate. And we would run up against that a lot, where, and partly with Enterprise too, where we were trying to do something different. At least that was the original intent of it, was to sort of, coming off of Voyager, this was what the way Rick kind of sold the show to me and the writers that he hired, was it was supposed to be more like the right stuff in outer space, that there was a feeling that Voyager had gotten, you know, a little overly intellectual, a little aloof, a little sterile. And part of the intent of Enterprise was to do kind of what JJ's movies did then later, was to make Star Trek fun again, you know, to make it good old-fashioned, two-fisted. You know, they cast Scott Bakula as the captain, and he was going to be getting in fistfights.
Yeah. Everybody was walking around wearing those red hats that said, make Star Trek fun again.
Yeah, exactly. The Maffa, Maspa.
Yeah. It's a whole movement.
But so you had that, and then you also had this conflict between that saying, we're going to bust the paradigm, but you can't bust it too much because people will get upset.
Yeah.
You know, and you need to be reverential to canon. And
that always seems to be the tension, right?
Yeah. Well, and I felt there was a way to do it. I mean, I felt there was a way. If you looked at, I remember having a lot of spirited discussions in the writer's room with Rick and the other writers about how badly could you, and how bad a light could you paint Starfleet characters?
Right.
You know, and Rick was very adamant in that this was Gene's utopian future, and Starfleet officers had evolved beyond sort of interpersonal confrontations, and they were all enlightened, and they all got along. And if you take a bunch of people who all get along, how do you create drama in trying to write a television show? So we were constantly trying to push it, and I would pull original series out and go, look at the relationship between Spock and McCoy. McCoy in some of those episodes is a flat out racist. He says the most vile, hateful, racist things to Spock in some of those episodes.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't mean that they're not, at the end of the day, colleagues and shipmates and
doesn't
and
mean
friends,
he doesn't get to come to Thanksgiving.
Exactly. There's a seat at the table for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's still like very upsetting and kind of triggering for Spock to see him at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly.
But he knows that that's part of the deal.
There were a lot of challenges, and it was trying to invent something new. I think there was a little Star Trek fatigue at the time. You know, I think if they had rested the show for a season or two and allow sort of the hunger for the franchise to build again, the way I think it ultimately did by the time they did the first JJ movie, it might have had a better chance at success. But the studio was eager to keep Star Trek on the air.
Yeah.
And so we sort of rushed into it. Look, there's a lot of episodes of, I feel that show is kind of sadly gets the least amount of respect. It's a little bit of the redheaded stepchild of the of the franchise.
Right.
But there's a lot of work. There's a bunch of crappy episodes of Enterprise. It's like I cannot defend. But there's a lot of work we did on the show that I was really proud of. You know, you had a group of people who loved Star Trek and were trying really hard to do something fun and new and different with,
yeah,
and keep the franchise alive and vibrant and you know, keep people interested in watching it. But the fan, I mentioned before, you know, it was also incredibly challenging and is incredibly challenging for the people who are doing it now to deal with such a passionate fan base, because everybody feels they have ownership of the show. Everybody feels that they have a very specific idea of how these stories should play and how these characters should act. I mean, and not everyone's going to get their way. You know, I remember, and this was largely pre-internet.
Yeah.
So there were the online, you know, fan boards and stuff like that, but that was about it. So we would get mail. I mean, actual mail.
Like signed in blood?
Well, no. Probably. The best one we ever got was someone sent a box to the writer's room. And the stuff, there was no filter. This was like pre-9/11. There was like no security. Stuff wasn't screened. If you just wrote Star Trek Paramount Los Angeles and threw it in the mail, it would end up in our offices. And someone sent us a box, just a cardboard box that they had filled with essentially what looked like the contents of their kitchen garbage can. It was like, you know, coffee grounds and eggshells and garbage. They sent us a box of garbage.
Hey, Ben moved with a box of that just recently.
With a note that said, this is what you have done to Star Trek.
Wow. Gosh.
So did you have to like put on some rubber gloves to pull the note out? Yeah.
No, the assistant did that.
Okay. I'm familiar roughly with how television works.
Yeah. But you didn't dismiss it. The funny thing is you didn't dismiss that kind of stuff. You would take that home with you, not the garbage, but you would be like, someone hates what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, you would never just go screw them. You know, I'm writing the stories I want to write. You took the weight of that very seriously. If people were calling and filling the voicemail box as they would every Monday morning, you'd come in and the thing couldn't accept any more messages because all the people screaming about the terrible episodes we'd done.
I was reading this like manifesto is like written in like 18th century political language. This manifesto that's going around online of people that are like declaring independence from Star Wars because they're so mad about the way the new movies are.
Right.
Like, I don't know. I've essentially dedicated my life to talking about Star Trek at this point, but I don't even feel like I'm that passionate about it.
Well, I think you can't lose sight of the fact that it's a dramatic entertainment. You know, I mean, it's as to quote William Shatner from Saturday Night Live, it's a television show. It's an incredibly important television show. It was an incredibly groundbreaking and significant television show that's touched a lot of people's lives, my own included, in very dramatic ways that have carried us all forward through 40 years. You know, I don't want to.
I mean, we get stuff for our podcast. Like, I mean, for all the nice letters we get one or two like incredibly vitriolic ones from time to time, and they do really stick with you. Like the
I think people don't understand that there's a human being on the other end of that. You know, that it's like I said before. It's like there are some episodes of Enterprise that I wince when I look at, and I go, but no, we never set out to piss all over the memory of Star Trek. It's like it all started with the best of intentions. We thought this one's going to be good. This is a good idea. Let's do this. And then sometimes, you know, you watch in horror as the slow motion train wreck unfolds in front of you. It's like, oh my God, this is just.
This didn't come together
the
way.
This did not come together. We all hoped. And doing 22, I think at the time we were doing 24 in a season, it was like triage. You didn't have time to fix every single one. Sometimes you would just have to go, oh my God, we just got to let this one.
It's either this or a clip show, guys. Which do you want?
This one's got to die. This patient's going to die on the table, or else the three guys in the waiting room aren't going to make it. But that's the thing that was hurtful, I think, when you know, when people would get upset and vocally upset, was there was the sense that they loved it more than we did. And I don't, having seen...
Did you get the same kind of vitriol for your two seasons of Sliders? Like, why did you cut the budget, you jerks?
Probably, but they didn't have a forum. Yeah. It was like, there was
no... Right, it was too early.
It was too early. So it was like, you know, and plus no one was watching it at that point anyway, so...
More of a light subject. Adam and I have long been lobbying for some involvement with Star Trek Discovery, running kind of like a dark horse outsider campaign. Originally, we were, you know, like Discovery had been announced, and we thought maybe it'd be fun to try and be in the writer's room for it, given that we've thought a lot about Star Trek.
Right.
I think that was like the amount of entitlement we were bringing to that campaign.
Hey, we think about this a lot. You should put us on the show.
Yeah, but then we wound up really liking the show, you know, and now we're thinking what we want is to be extras in the hallway when the ship gets hit and we get blown out into space.
Sucked out
into
space. Okay. Yeah. There you go.
What do you think the likelihood is, having been on the inside of two noisy idiots from the internet, getting something like that going?
Well, the first thing I have to say is I have no connection whatsoever to...
I'm not asking you to
hire
us.
But I just want to be upfront about that.
Thanks very much, Chris Black, for being on the show.
Yeah.
Okay,
thanks, guys.
We gotta go.
I cannot put in a call for you because I don't know those guys.
I'm asking you more to like speculate. Like, would that have ever...
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it happened all the time.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't... when we were doing it, it wasn't necessarily podcasters, but,
right.
You know, but there were people I remember we would have...
Hey, there's this guy that we really like that sent us a box of kitchen trash, and yeah, exactly. We just think he's got a really cool vibe.
Let's blow him out an airlock. Yeah,
but like a real one.
No, they would have... I remember we had some sailors came once from the actual aircraft carrier Enterprise and came to visit... Sad. Oh, yeah.
Very famous nuclear vessel.
Yeah, exactly. Where are the nuclear vessels? and they put them in uniforms and put them in the background. And I think we had some NASA people come one time. And it was not... I don't remember what the criteria was, you know, but it was not at all uncommon to have people on the show who, you know, who had some...
So you're saying
connection.
We need to join the Navy.
It wouldn't hurt. Or NASA. Or go into space.
Okay.
Go into space. Spend some time on the International Space Station. I think they'll put you on the show in a heartbeat.
They'll do anything at that
exactly.
point. Yeah.
They'll have you there. Or be like Stephen Hawking or something.
Yeah, I don't know how much of the envelope of theoretical physics I'm going to push personally.
No, but I'd say it's you're not alone. You know, there are many, many people who would love to don that uniform, you know, and that myself included. I never actually wound up on the show.
Yeah.
I think partly because at the time I was just too crazy busy to ever take the hours out of my day to go stand around and do it. But I think at one point or another, most of the other writers did.
Oh, that's fun.
And going to the wardrobe department was one of the coolest things, you know, in my experience working on the show, because they had Robert Blackman, who was the costume designer at the time, who's just a genius, which is not a word I throw around, and also one of the loveliest human beings you'll ever work with, did such brilliant work. But they had every costume they'd had like ever made. You know, you would go.
That is fun.
They just racks and racks.
Did they
racks.
Have it on one of those things like at a dry cleaner where they call up like G74?
Well, I think they would have loved if they'd had that. It would have made things so much easier. No, they were just crammed into this crowd.
Or
crowded,
like Cher Horowitz
ancient...
and Clueless, where they pick out the pants, the shirt, and the hat.
if people could see behind the scenes at the production of Star Trek and see how low tech and primitive it was. It was so anti Star Trek.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you would walk back there, and they always got hounded at Halloween because people wanted outfits to wear.
Sure.
But you would walk back there, and they'd be like, "Oh yeah, here, these are the Starfleet uniforms from Wrath of Khan," and these are. It was like, and it was all just hanging there in dry cleaning bags.
Wow.
You know, decades of history.
Man, it's amazing that Paul Allen hasn't bought most of that stuff.
He may have by now.
My people were biologically determined for one purpose alone, to sense the coming of death.
What?
To sense the coming of death.
This doesn't make any sense.
I sense it coming now.
None of it makes any sense.
Sounds like nonsense to me.
What do you make of the abuse allegations in the Star Trek Discovery writer's room, and how do you personally like to cultivate a creative atmosphere that you want it to be, but also that is productive and schedule focused the way that it needs to be?
Look, I cannot speak to that situation because
sure.
I was not on that show.
That's why I made it a two-part question. Like,
yeah. So, I mean, with that, I have to speak with that caveat.
Sure.
You know, I think people need to be treated with respect. And I think in the shows that I've run and the shows I've worked on, it goes back a little bit to what I said before, that there's a lot of responsibility to doing a television show, additional responsibility to doing Star Trek. They're giving you tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
And trusting you with something that's worth potentially billions of dollars to them. So there's a tremendous amount of pressure, and everybody takes that very seriously, and you run up against deadlines, and it's hard. It's a hard job. But at the end of the day, it is a television show.
Yeah.
And most of the people working on it are doing jobs that are their dream jobs. They're their creative mm-hmm. dream jobs. They're getting to work in the entertainment industry that they always wanted to do. They're getting to be writers and actors and
yeah.
and production people. And so my philosophy has always been, yes, there's a lot of pressure. Yes, there's a lot of responsibility, but it should always be fun.
Yeah.
And every time they let me on a set, like what I was saying before, when you walked onto those Star Trek sets, it was like you'd died and gone to heaven. It was like, this is what I'd wanted to do since I was 15 years old. So I always try to be grateful and bear that in mind. Now, all of that said, you are also in a room whose job, the job by definition, is to create drama.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you are creating dramatic situations and conflict between people to put on the screen. And nearly every writer's room I've ever been in, they're crucibles, and the pot needs to be stirred, and people get passionate, and people shout, and people argue their points aggressively and passionately. I think
conflict averse only child, that sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, well, no, and it's in rooms can be very different, and they really are sort of driven by the temperament and the personality and the style of the person who's running it. You know,
right.
they can be a narcissistic tyrant, or they can be an incredibly nurturing and benevolent leader, you know, depending on who they get. But the nature of the beast is you're creating drama, and writers' rooms are by definition dramatic places.
Does the temperament of that room reflect the showrunner primarily, or does it mostly have to do with the gathering of people in that room?
Well, both, but you know, the leaders, the showrunners, it's the captain of the ship.
Yeah.
You follow that person's lead. It's like to make, you know, like when I was doing Enterprise, Scott Bakula is one of the nicest, most generous, professional people I've ever worked with in this business. And the fact that he showed up every day.
What does he have on you? What dirt does he have on you that you're terrified he'll put out there?
No, he's just the greatest guy. And it was like, but he led by example.
Yeah.
You know, no, you had a lot of younger actors, you know, people who were getting their big breaks, first time, first TV series coming in, who if Scott had been a towering asshole, they would have been like, oh, that's how you're supposed to act. That's right. How we're allowed to act. It would have allowed that behavior to flourish.
Sets a precedent.
Set a precedent for that. But because Scott wasn't that guy and set this precedent of just courtesy and professionalism, that's what everyone followed. And a writer's room is really the same way. I mean, the showrunner sets the tone. I've run a show myself, and you allow a lot of times some back and forth in the room, but you've got to know when to sort of moderate it and be the referee and say, okay, that's enough. We're going to keep it civil. We're not going to do this idea. We're going to do that idea. Someone's got to be the boss and make the final decision. So that was a little bit of a, I would say, nuanced or equivocating answer to your question. But
I mean, I think that that's like, in a weird way, like one of the main motifs that Star Trek has had for every series is like the captain is such a key figure.
Yes.
And what the captain is about colors everything, you know, like everything about the show.
Right.
I mean, I think Discovery had like one of the most interesting ones because the captain turned out to be a villain.
Exactly.
And it did feel weird on the ship
right.
before we had that reveal.
Well, I used to joke, as much as I adored Scott, that one of the reasons that maybe Enterprise was not as successful a show.
Not enough shots of the dog.
Porthos, where no dog has gone before. That dog, man, we could spend another hour here talking about the dog. But was that he was almost too nice. he was too nice. And one of the reasons that I was such an original series fan, one of the things that I thought made Kirk such a great Starfleet captain was that William Shatner was kind of a egomaniac. It was kind of a narcissistic asshole, you know, that, you know, I don't think I'm telling tales out of school. I think it's fairly well known that he's, you know, has that personality, but it's like it came through in that performance.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of, you need a certain arrogance to sit in that chair.
Yeah.
You know, and
kind of guy who looks at himself in the mirror and goes like, I like what I see.
Yeah, that's right. There it is.
Yeah.
All of it. And you know, in a way, Scott was a little too much of an Eagle Scout, you know. But they can be contentious places. And I think sometimes they need to be contentious places to generate conflict and good story.
You can have contentiousness without disrespect or hostility.
Yes. But everyone should be, at the end of the day, needs to be treated respectfully. Absolutely. And that does come from the leadership in the room.
When Rick and Brannon brought you in, did they fence the yard as far as the Star Trek universe at all, to the degree where you knew more or less where you needed to be in that first season of Enterprise? Or was it totally blank slate and a timeline that you guys were given?
I wouldn't say it was totally blank slate. And it changed, the landscape changed a little under our feet, I think, as we got into that first season. Like I started to say, it was when I first went in and sat down with Rick and he kind of laid out what the show was supposed to be. You know, there was a sense of, they wanted Star Trek, you know, we had our Make Star Trek Fun Again hats on. It mm-hmm. was like, it was going to be exciting. It was going to be dangerous. That was the whole thing about setting it 100 years before, was that the technology.
It did feel really dangerous in a way that felt new.
Yeah. And that was the whole thing. That was the way he pitched it, was it's the right stuff in outer space. These are the test pilots.
Right.
This is an NX class ship. This is an experimental prototype. There aren't star bases all over the place. These guys are out there on their own, you know, with nothing but their wits, you know, and their resourcefulness to save them. And I remember sitting in Rick's office and he's like going, it's gonna, you know, people are gonna die, shit is gonna break, you know, I was like, sign me up. You know, I've been waiting for this show for 20 years. It's like, it sounds awesome, you know. Yeah.
Did you guys form the characters?
No, well, I came in after the pilot had been shot.
Okay.
So Rick and Brannon had already conceived the show, pitched the show, had written that 2-hour pilot episode, which I thought was a very good pilot, and had shot it. And, you know, so that it was all that, those parameters, those fences were already up. So this is what the world is going to be. This is the ship. Here's the cast. Here's the crew.
I liked the retcon that Vulcans think humans are smelly.
Well, and that was the other thing too, was you tried to be respectful of canon, but also it was frustrating sometimes because you didn't want to be so slavish that it restricted your ability to tell fun stories.
Yeah.
You know,
I feel like that's where the fan rage thing happens, is 100%. Like they get real fixated on the mythos, and then if something kind of slightly violates it can feel really upsetting.
Absolutely. And look, understandably, you know,
not to other fans, like obviously we're fans too, but I'm just saying, like, when people get upset, I feel like it's because it feels like it's undoing something that they love.
Well, and that was the hard thing too, was that it was like, you know, as I said, we had 700 hours of television that you felt you couldn't, you know, that precedent had, it was like arguing a Supreme Court case, you know, precedent had been set so many times that I always felt my approach was, stick to the spirit of the law, if not the letter. You know, that if we stick to the spirit of the Star Trek canon and don't do anything that violates the world that Star Trek had created, even if we fudge little things here and there and this doesn't quite fit, or we had to retcon it, or we're a little bit straying a little bit outside canon, but was it in service of a great episode, in service of a great story? I was far more forgiving of that, I think, than a lot of people were, which then earned us boxes of garbage.
Well, it's been a long way getting from there to here. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, the song. You want to talk about the song?
Yeah, was that your fault? Or?
You know, I will confess, I didn't hate the song.
I don't hate that song. I think I like the first version, because didn't they change it?
They tried to sort of make it edgier.
I liked the original version of the song.
I loved the I think it took a lot of flack because that particular song had been from that movie Patch Adams.
Oh.
And so it felt like it was not a good provenance for a Star Trek theme. And also that it was the first show that hadn't had an orchestral score, you know, an orchestral theme. But that also played into what they wanted, Rick and Brandon wanted to say from that opening credits, we're doing something
different. This is
different.
A different show.
It's a different show. We're doing something different. And I loved the visuals that the opening credit sequence they designed, I thought were great.
Yeah, they were cool.
And they wanted to do that song. And I think is it a great song? No.
I always wondered, is that actually the shot from First Contact with the missile?
Taking off.
Did they have to re-render it for clearance reasons?
That I couldn't tell you.
Yeah,
I always assumed it was the first shot because it just looked like the same shot because it looked like it to me. But I couldn't tell you. But I always felt, even though it was not a great song, if you listened to the words, I always thought that spirit embraced what that song was saying, what we wanted to say with the show.
It did have like a little bit of a like Christian rock vibe to it definitely. In a way that I think
I can't argue with
clashes you. With Star Trek from a tonal perspective.
They had a bunch of different versions of it.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was that the same visuals, that opening credit sequence, but set to U2's A Beautiful Day. And it was great.
I bet that was in the budget.
Yeah. You know, but it was like, you know, I was like, let's do that. And
yeah.
I don't know that Rick was a U2 fan, or it was too expensive, or whatever. Who knows? But we didn't do it. Well, the other thing does, you didn't do contemporary music on the show because it wasn't, so we had no music budget. It wasn't a contemporary show. So.
Did they have any Rage Against the Machine version or Beastie Boys version?
There may have been.
I mean, Rage Against the Machine would actually be appropriate because they're communist. It's like the socialist space future.
Exactly. You know? It was like our utopian vision of our socialist space future. We're all raging against the warp drive.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, are you working on anything now that you think a Star Trek audience would be curious about?
Oh, well, the only thing I'll do a quick shameless plug because the last show I worked on, I worked for two seasons running the show called Outcast, which was a Cinemax show based on the Robert Kirkman comic.
Okay.
And the second season, and no one has Cinemax, so
yeah, that's I've never heard of it, and
which
I don't
is why,
have Cinemax.
Yes, exactly. You know, unless you're, you know, as I once said to one of our Cinemax executives, the only reason I have it and I have a show on your network is because I got it for free and forgot to cancel it, and he was like, "Dude, you and everybody else." But the second season of Outcast premieres this month on Cinemax. We worked really hard on it. I think it's really good. So, okay. And it also co-stars Brent Spiner.
Hey.
Who all of your fans will know. Who was a lovely guy, a wonderful actor, and a lovely guy to work for. So if you do have Cinemax or can get it off your parents' DirecTV.
Use mom and dad's login. And
please watch it.
Chris Black, thank you so much for coming and talking to us on The Greatest Discovery.
Thank you, guys. It was my absolute pleasure.
Yeah.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Benjamin R. Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Head on over to MaximumFun.org/donate to help with the ongoing production of our show, or leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is @CutForTime, and I'm @RobKSchulte. Make sure to use the hashtag GreatestGen or GreatestDiscovery when talking about the show.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.